The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
When the IEA says that it recommends these steps, it says that it's part of this plan to address the fact that we are in a major energy crisis. Is the IEA exaggerating when it calls this a major crisis that's set to get worse over the next couple of years?
No, we're in a major crisis. I mean, Russia is the world's biggest oil exporter, the third biggest oil producer. It's also a major producer of natural gas. Western Europe is very dependent upon it, but it ships oil and gas all over the world. If that gets removed from the system, that's a huge deal. Remember, the oil market in particular is the kind of market that moves around on, you know, a few hundred thousand barrels a day. Here we're talking upwards of maybe 2.5 million barrels a day being taken out of the system. And I think what people aren't seeing, we've all seen the fluctuations in the oil price, but what they aren't seeing is perhaps a gathering crisis happening in the background, which I call a liquidity crisis. And it comes in two forms. You know, one is capital is being withdrawn from the oil market. The second is liquidity in the form of barrels, barrels being withdrawn from the market. And in Russia's case, that's a real problem because at some point, if Russian supply is cut off from the market for long enough, it will back up in the Russian system. They'll be forced to shut in wells. And the one thing we know about the Russian oil system is it does not handle shut-ins very well. If that oil goes away, it's very hard to bring it back on.
It's not like a flip of the switch.
No, just by way of illustrating that, when oil production collapsed in Russia, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it didn't get back to that level until 2016.
Okay. So that's a pretty good indication that it's this is something that will persist for years to come, even if the war ends tomorrow, which it's unlikely to.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, this week was chock full of catalysts, so let's get right into it. The U.S. stock market rallied strongly this week on the drop in oil prices, the hope that talks between Ukraine and Russia would result in a ceasefire, and hope that Chairman Powell and the rest of the Fed voters won't have a preconceived glide path for rates and will remain flexible should recession fears arise. Of course, the Fed is in a precarious position. Businesses are experiencing tight labor markets, higher prices, and supply chain issues that have not been resolved. In fact, just this week, investors took the news in stride on Monday that China has put Shenzhen on lockdown due to COVID. Shenzhen is a major tech hub and home to 18 million people. Luckily, the news suggests the lockdown will only last until March 20th. Investors were happier with falling energy prices than the concerns of a lockdown for the week, and so the S&P 500 found support at that 4,200 level to kick things off. The rally began really in earnest Tuesday in front of major FOMC meeting here on Wednesday because sentiment was that most of what the Fed had been planning and discussing was built already into the depressed stock correction that began in early January when Powell suggested the balance sheet would be allowed to shrink soon after the first rate hike. Sentiment, too, has been considered very negative here, and in spite of a 10% year-over-year increase in the producer price index, stocks rose on Tuesday. Turning to the major event this week was the Federal Reserve meeting in which the Fed funds rate was increased for the first time since 2018, a quarter point. President Bullard casted his dissent, stating he wanted a 50 basis point hike. He's not alone. As another voting member, Chris Waller, on Friday said the Fed should consider a 50 basis point hike at one or multiple meetings in the future and reduce the balance sheet by July. As we were previously told in January, the Fed intends to reduce its balance sheet at a coming meeting. This is in stark contrast to the last time the Fed had left off for rates and the balance sheet was allowed to continue to increase for some time. The summary for the economic projections, which we get about every quarter, showed a Fed funds rate at 1.9% by the end of this year versus the 0.9% we had previously at the last projection, suggesting 7 hikes this year. Additionally, projections for the rate next year are at 2.8%, which runs higher than the long-run average of 2.4% suggested by the Fed for its long-term average. This would indicate that the Fed will enter into a restrictive policy mode to combat inflation in 2023. This, of course, led to a flattening of the yield curve. And at one point, the 10-year and the 5-year Treasury yields inverted, meaning the 5-year Treasury yield was about 3 basis points higher than the longer-term yield, which is not normal. As I look at rates now, those two are both flat on the day here on Friday at 2.15% for both. The biggest increase in the past week for rates was in the 2-year Treasury, which is the most sensitive to Fed hikes. And that was up 49 basis points over the past month here on Friday, with the 10-year Treasury only up 22 basis points in the past month. The 2-year and the 10-year spread, which is widely watched, has narrowed to only 20 basis points at this point in time. All this communicates that investors envision the Fed will eventually cut off growth. The initial reaction by the investors was a rout in previous gains on the day. Treasury yields spiked and stocks fell. But comments from Powell seemed to soothe investors after the policy statement was made. Before the Fed decision was announced, the S&P 500 was up 1.3%. After the decision, stocks fell and the S&P 500 was in negative territory, down 0.3% for the day. When Powell spoke, the first thing he said was that the probability of recession this year is low. He said the lower growth projections are mainly tied to the geopolitical landscape and not based on the projection and plans for the increase in rates. However, he did acknowledge that monetary policy could be the determinant factor over inflation and growth in 2023 and 2024, when the Fed projects interest rates will be above their longer run rate of 2.4%. Another catalyst that fell in foreign investors' lap Wednesday was an announcement by China it was going to support its stock market, backing overseas listings and ending the crackdown on internet media platforms soon. The Hang Seng Enterprise Index rose 13%, and stocks like Alibaba and Tencent rose 20% on the day. The People's Bank of China also chimed in on Wednesday to support capital markets, and this helped to offset some of the fears that China may get more involved with Russia and Ukraine. It was a very eventful week, to say the least, which focused primarily on hopes that the Ukraine-Russia conflict could see a ceasefire soon. There was a drop in oil prices initially, and finally, Chairman Powell soothed investors with the rate increase, poured a little honey, and suggested that a probability of recession this year was low. Up next, Tom McClellan, our technician guest for the week, so stay tuned.
David Wu, the former B of A strategist and economist at the IMF, joined FS Insider this week to talk about a Cold War 2.0, a Russian debt default, and the biggest trend over the next 20 years.
If U.S. sanctions succeed in setting back Russia, that means we're going to continue to experience the shortage in commodities. Forget about oil. Okay. Forget about wheat. Forget about palladium. Just talking about neon gas. Between Russia and Ukraine, they control 80% of the world's production in neon gas, an essential ingredient in producing semiconductors. Right now, all the major semiconductor manufacturers have got exactly 1 week's supply left of neon gas.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Stock prices are coming back a bit. Is this just a dead cat bounce? Where do we go from here? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, congratulations and kudos, by the way. You're on target, Tom. Last time we had you on the show was in November. You said that was the peak in the market, and you were spot on. So where do we go from here, my friend?
Well, we're supposed to have a generally sideways year this year, but it doesn't go flat sideways. There's always some texture. And so we're forming, not today, but soon, we're forming a meaningful low within the context of a sideways year. And I suppose I should let your listeners know that you and I are talking about this a little over an hour ahead of the FOMC meeting announcement, when they're going to tell us what they did with the interest rates. And so we're clueless right now as to what they did, but your listeners will probably be hearing it after that's already happened. So everybody should understand that context.
Okay. Now, you have sent a couple of charts, and I'd like to begin with that. And we're going to put these on our website so our listeners can go to our website and follow along. as you explain them. The first one looks at bearish sentiment, I believe. And what is this telling you right now?
Yeah, let me explain that a little bit. This is survey data from the folks at Investors Intelligence, and they have somewhere between 150 and 200 newsletter writers and investment advisors that they track and see whether we are bullish or bearish. This is looking only at the percentage of bears, which is at its highest level since the COVID crash now. I plotted it on an inverted scaling in this chart so that we can better see the correlation to prices. And not surprisingly, when prices are going down, investment advisors get more bearish. And when prices are going up, they get more bullish because they're all humans and they respond to what the prices do. What we're seeing, though, is a couple interesting things right now. The first thing is that this chart goes all the way back to 1990, and you can see that there's generally been a drift toward less bearishness over time in this really, really long-term chart. And if you think about that, it makes sense because the people who were writing stock market newsletters in the 1990s, they'd probably lived through the 70s. And so they were used to bad times and they were used to needing to turn bearish more. The people who are doing it now live through the 80s and the 90s and QE 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so they're used to buy and hold working out eventually. So they're going to just generally be more bullish. And so as the old ones retire and die off and get replaced by younger ones, you see that that persistent trend toward less bearishness over time. But within that trend, what we can see is that there are extreme deviations from the middle ground. And we're in one of those extreme deviations right now with bears at, I think, 36%, which is pretty extreme. You wouldn't think it could get a lot more extreme, and it did in 2008. But this is a pretty sizable increase in the amount of bearishness. It looks like a dip plotted on this inverted scaling of the chart. And that makes sense because we've had about a little over 10% decline in the S&P 500, more in the NASDAQ because it has a higher beta. And that's resulted in people getting really pessimistic to a degree that is generally associated with meaningful bottoms for prices. However, that doesn't mean that the bottom has to be here at this moment today, just because we notice that people are getting pessimistic. We're close to a meaningful bottom, which I wouldn't confuse with being the bottom, but a bottom of substance, which is ideally due later this month to early April. I'm expecting it ideally on March 23rd.
Now, the second chart that you have, I find rather interesting. This is the Fed funds target rate. And Tom, I wonder if you might add a little, get a little granular with this, because on the day we're talking, the two-year note is at 1.85. And then the 10-year note is at 2.15. So it looks like the yield curve is not only flattening, but is at risk of inverting. So what is this chart telling our listeners?
Well, this is a comparison of the 2-year note yield to the Fed funds target rate. And the Fed's fund target rate is what the Fed announces after its 8 meetings per year and the announcement that we're looking forward to. And everybody's debating whether the Fed's going to raise a quarter point or a half a point. The 2-year note yield will tell us better than anything that the Fed does or says. It'll tell us what the Fed ought to do. And the 2-year note yield is up at 1.8%, which is telling us that if the Fed wants to get to a neutral stance, meaning non-stimulative, they should raise all the way to 1.75, and they should do it all at once and rip the Band-Aid off and get the job done. When the Fed is slow to act and when it's behind the curve, it tends to fuel bubbles and cause problems. When it's slow to cut, it exacerbates recessions. And so we're seeing a huge instance of the Fed being asleep at the switch. The 2-year note yield has been rising and the Fed has not acted. I don't know if they're ever going to get around to doing their job. If it was up to me, I would throw out the FOMC and I would just outsource their job of setting interest rate policy to the 2-year bond yield. And we could save a whole bunch on travel costs and salaries and get arguably a better outcome. The Fed rate hike cycles that we've seen in the past, they end at the point when the Fed catches up to the 2-year note yield. So do you want the rate hike cycle to end years from now and cause damage? Or do you want it to end now and get the job done? That's the philosophical question I'm posing. I would argue for setting the rate at the right place right now. And if the 2-year note yield moves and tells you need to move the Fed funds rate to something else, then adjust to that. But the Fed is really asleep at the switch. They are exacerbating the 8% inflation that we're seeing in CPI 10% in the PPI. They're making things worse, as is the Congress with all its extra COVID spending that they've done. They've really thrown a lot of gasoline on the fire as people are going back to work, and there's lots of extra money sloshing around. And the Fed is just standing by and not doing its job. I think somebody ought to get fired.
Yeah, because I'm taking a look at this. We got a PPI print of 10% year over year on Tuesday. And Tom, that isn't reflecting what's going on with owner's equivalent rent. The Wall Street Journal talked about the biggest apartment REITs are talking about 15 to 16% rental increases. We've got rising wages and labor, not even talking about where oil prices are right now. And speaking of oil, I know you have one more chart I want to get to, but just speaking to oil right now, we saw a precipitous climb all the way up to almost 130. As we're speaking, we're at around 96. What's your take on oil?
Well, the best leading indication for what oil prices are going to do is drawn from gold prices. If you watch what gold prices do, then oil prices do just about exactly the same thing about 20 months later. So we've been looking for a mid-March peak in oil prices to match the August 2020 peak in gold prices. And we've gotten the climb up toward that. The Ukraine war put a thumb on the scale and adjusted the timing of the peak and the magnitude of it a little bit, because it's a little bit like trying to give you the surf forecast for Southern California on the day that the asteroid falls in the ocean. You can have a perfectly good meteorological surf forecast, but you can have an event come along that will skew things a little bit. I think we have seen the peak. I don't think oil is going to exceed that peak that you just mentioned, but I don't think that we start downward right away. We will be starting downward, and we will be seeing lower oil prices as the summer unfolds. But I think from a day-to-day standpoint, here we are in mid-March, I don't think that we're going to start downward right away. And there may be a little bit more thrashing around here up at the high levels before we get a meaningful decline in oil prices. But we will see one.
I want to go to your next chart, which is corporate high bond yield advanced decline line. And one of the things we've been watching is paying close attention to the credit markets, Tom. And we're seeing this widening spread between treasuries and junk bonds. So what is this chart telling?
Well, this is an advanced decline line. And for your newer listeners, let me define that. We look at the corporate high yield bond statistics that are maintained by FINRA, and they count. They look at those bonds and they count how many of them went up each day and how many of them went down. The difference between the advances and the declines every day is known as the breadth. And if you sum those daily breadth readings over time on a continuous basis, you get what's known as an advanced decline line. And that's what this is. And the fact that the red line, the advanced decline line, has been going downward lately, that just means that there have been more of these high yield bonds that are declining every day than advancing. And generally speaking, high-yield bonds will most of the time do whatever the stock market is doing. They don't behave like treasury bonds do, because the default risk is much greater for the high-yield bonds, and thus their sensitivity to the liquidity situation is much greater. That's really useful to us as stock market investors, because these are the canaries that will tell you about the bad gases in the coal mine long before the coal miners start dropping from methane or carbon monoxide. When the canaries start dying, you know that liquidity is drying up and it's a big problem. That's the signal that we got last fall when we saw this high yield bond advanced decline line peak in September, well ahead of the final price highs in November and December for stocks. And they were heading down. They were saying liquidity has dried up. Liquidity is a problem. And eventually that liquidity problem is going to come around to bite the stock market, which it has in 2022. The message today, right now, this advanced decline line is still falling. It is still acting bearish. It is still saying liquidity is a problem. And so that means that the stock market is not going to get healthy very soon, because the bond market and the financial markets have not addressed this liquidity problem. The Fed is going to exacerbate that, I hope, by starting to raise short-term interest rates, as they should. And the bond market and the financial markets are just going to have to work their way through that. At the point when we start seeing these high-yield bonds start to perform better, then we can have a little bit more confidence that the stock market can bounce. I'm looking for a temporary low for stock prices due late March to the first week of April. That'll just be a trading low, give us about a six-week bounce into May. Then I'm looking for a lower low the first week of July. And that'll be the low that you really want to buy as an investor, because we're looking for a possibility of a nice return upward movement for stock prices from that early July bottom. The message here, though, is that liquidity situation has not yet healed.
So if you were looking longer term, you said this year is going to be kind of like a sideways year, a lot of bumps along the way. If you were looking beyond this, because after this year, we get into the presidential cycle for the 2024 election. We have midterms coming in November. Cycle-wise, what lies ahead of us?
Yeah, and I mentioned it'd be a flat year, a sideways year, but I would call it violently sideways. And so we're experiencing some of that violence right now. And it's going to create an opportunity for that low in early July, which will confuse everybody because seasonality says that you're supposed to see the market peak in May to July. And I think that the stock market's going to go against that normal annual seasonal tendency this year, which will confuse everybody. The third year of a presidential term, which will be 2023, is nearly always an up year. So for the market to continue being in a bearish mode next year will be awfully difficult because it'll be really fighting some strong historical tendencies. It has happened. It can happen. It happened in 1931 when we were in the throes of the Great Depression. It happened in 1939, that the third year of a presidential term was a down year, but that was when Hitler was marching through Poland. So if we get conditions like that in 2023, yes, the market can go down in spite of the normal presidential cycle tendencies. But for long-term investors, I would say if you're sitting in cash, stay there and don't get an itchy trigger finger waiting to jump back in. Not just yet. July would be a better time.
Well, let me throw a grenade into that scenario. Let's suppose two things. Either one, the Fed commits a policy mistake, they tighten too much, or on the opposite direction, they don't tighten enough and inflation continues. How would that alter this?
As to the first scenario, the Fed tightening too much, I can't believe that's going to happen because they are so far away now from where the too much level is that I don't think this group of people can actually get themselves there. If they hiked instantaneously from 0 to 2%, then you could argue that yes, that was too much. But if they're going to do a quarter point or a half a point, they're still a long way from the 1.8% yield on the two-year note, which is the best guideline for what the Fed should do. If the Fed undershoots, then we're still going to have inflation. It's still going to really grind the economy and create stagnance where it shouldn't happen. We also have the risk of China shutting down their supply lines even more this week because of COVID outbreaks there, and that remains a risk. Hopefully, we're not going to go through the stupid mistakes that we did in the U.S. shutting down our economy here again. Hopefully, all the policymakers have learned from those mistakes and won't repeat them this time.
All right. Well, listen, so it's going to be a very bumpy ride this year with some great opportunities coming up midsummer. Tom, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you do some really great stuff. And once again, congratulations on your call last November as the market peak. How could they follow you?
Come check us out on our website. It's mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed. MCOscillator.com. You can see our free learning center, lots of free articles so you can peruse. Every weekly chart and focus article going back to 2009 is posted there. If you want the good stuff, though, we have a twice monthly newsletter called the McClellan Market Report, and we also have a daily edition. Comes out every day the market trades. If you sign up in the month of March, you can still take advantage of our current pricing. We're finally going to have our first price increase since we started our business in 1995. We were single-handedly trying to hold the line against inflation, but we're failing. And so we're going to implement a price increase effective on March 30th. But if you sign up now, you can lock in the current pricing before that price increase goes into effect. MCOscillator.com.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Once again, congratulations on your call and come back again.
This week, geopolitical strategist and expert Riva Gujan joined FS Insider to discuss China's strategy in the Russia-Ukraine war, trading oil for China's RMB, as well as the steps that China is going to take to avoid the nuclear option. Here's a clip of what she told listeners this week on FS Insider.
China is very interested in pushing this narrative of the decline of the U.S.-led global order, the rise of a multipolar order in which major players like China, also Russia, have a prominent place in this new geopolitical climate, that they have the right to assert their territorial integrity, their national sovereignty, and resolve what they perceive as unfinished chapters in their modern history.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the Fed raised interest rates for the first time, a quarter of a point, widely anticipated on Wall Street. The question is, how many more rate hikes will be coming this year, and what will that mean for the economy and the possibility of a recession? Let's find out. Joining us from Moody's is Ryan Sweet. What is your assessment of what the Fed will do this year? Will they get 7 rate hikes in, or will they stop before that?
So our forecast is that the Fed doesn't raise rates 7 times this year. You know, it's great to have a plan. I think markets expect, you know, a pretty, you know, steady pace of tightening, but things could go wrong. The tightening of financial market conditions, I think that's doing a lot of the Fed's heavy lifting. So I don't think they need to raise rates 7 times this year. And I think that's, you know, partly, attributed to expectations that the Fed is possibly going to overdo it and slow the economy too much, where that would lead to them backing off, probably this time next year. So our forecast has 4 rate hikes this year, 4 rate hikes next year, which would be, you know, generally more consistent with, past tightening cycles.
So if they get that high, we're watching the credit markets, and you're seeing credit spreads widen here. Are you guys concerned about that in terms of what you're seeing in the credit markets right now and what impact that might have coming from rate hikes?
Well, I pay very close attention to the corporate bond market, and credit markets in general. I mean, they're pretty good at sniffing out risks and concerns about, you know, future economic activity or a recession. Spreads have widened. If you look at high yield U.S. corporate bond spreads, they've noticeably widened over the last several weeks. They're still historically low. I mean, they're still well below what their historical average is, but just the pace of widening or how aggressively they've moved is a little bit of a cause for concern. Other things that I look at, I mean, if you look at the yield curve, which is the difference between, you know, the 10-year treasury yield and the 2-year treasury yield, that's compressed and it's flattening out. In the yield curve, I'm a little bit of a skeptic about the yield curve, but at least historically, it's been a pretty good indication of recession risk. And the bond market saying there's a heightened risk of a recession, not this year, but in the next 12 to 18 months. And I think that gets back to the idea, you know, the Fed has a very, very difficult job ahead. You know, they're going to try to land this, you know, plane perfectly on the tarmac, but they're going to be trying to do so when inflation is extremely high, compared to, you know, what we've seen over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Right now the CPI is close to 8% year over year. Before, in past tightening cycles, the Fed's, you know, been trying to do it while bringing inflation up. This time they're going to be trying to bring really high inflation down, but at the same time, not raising rates fast enough where they undermine the underlying economy.
So let's talk about some of the factors that have been raising inflation. Let's talk about energy for a minute. And then also something, tightening labor market. And that's something we're seeing wages start to rise. And that's something they may have to be dealing with in the second half of the year. How do you think this plays out?
I think it's going to be a bumpy road. You're right that the job market is doing very well. So if you look at the Fed's, you know, dual mandate, it's full employment and stable prices. Stable. We don't have stable prices right now. The Fed tries to aim for inflation around 2%. You know, right now we're closer to 8%. But what's driving that inflation is a couple of things. If you rank order them, you know, energy's number one, supply chain issues number two, and then way down the list is wages. Energy's being driven by an increase in global demand, and recently what's going on in Eastern Europe, that's caused energy prices to jump. The worst isn't behind us when it comes to energy. The CPI for March is going to show a noticeable increase in gasoline prices. We're feeling it at the pump. Anyone that's, you know, filled up recently has noticed gasoline prices have risen. So energy is going to be a big driver of inflation over the next few months. Supply chains, these are, you know, if you look at, we construct a supply chain component of the CPI. So we go through and look at, you know, what goods and services, mostly goods, are being disrupted by supply chains. And it's used cars, it's new cars, it's furniture, it's, bedding, audio equipment. And when you combine them all together, it shows that they're adding around 2.5 percentage points to year over year growth in the headline CPI. So that's a big chunk. Add in energy, that's another big chunk. That's another 2 percentage points. So when you strip that out, energy and supply chains, we have inflation that's above the Fed's target, but just not as glaring as the, you know, roughly 8% that we're seeing. So when it comes to wages, economists, we really worry about a wage price spiral, because that's when inflation can become a persistent issue. That's when we would usher in a new inflation regime. If, you know, people's wages are going up and we're pulling inflation higher, you know, you probably remember from intro to macroeconomics, demand pull inflation, you know, just too much money chasing too few goods, we're pulling prices higher. That's more persistent. That's stickier. Right now, the causation goes the other way. Inflation is pulling wages higher. And you know, that causation can switch, but it's very difficult to predict when and if it will occur. But if wage growth, you know, does start to contribute more to inflation, that's when we're going to have an issue.
You know, one issue, and speaking of supply chain, I'm just picked up in the news that in China, two of their largest provinces are being shut down because of COVID. So what impact might that have on the supply chain issues? Because a lot of what we buy here in the U.S. comes from China.
It does. And the supply chain issues, taking a step back, why we're experiencing supply chain issues is twofold. First, there's a lot of demand. So the U.S., we buy, you know, the U.S. consumer buys a lot of stuff, you know, goods. And if you look at retail sales in the U.S., they're well above their pre-pandemic level. And that's attributed to the pandemic. You know, people were hesitant to go out to restaurants, barbershops, movie theaters, sporting events. So we shifted the mix of spending away from services to goods. So we decided to buy a lot of stuff. And that put some pressure on supply chains. You know, retailers are trying to, you know, import a lot more goods. And then there was a supply problem. You know, not enough containers. You had production disruptions in Asia with the first couple of waves of the pandemic. Recently, supply chain stress in the U.S. has actually improved a little bit. It's still well above what it was pre-pandemic, but we've seen a little bit of improvement. But with China and their no COVID policy, you know, they have zero tolerance for it, and shutting down two of their large provinces will likely cause supply chain issues to deteriorate. So we'll see a little bit more stress over the next few months, just because we import a lot from China.
I want to throw another one in here, and that is housing. And could that be another problem on the horizon for inflation? You know, you have owner's equivalent rent. Rents here are going up double digits, and I've seen various REITs that are reporting that they're getting double digit rent increases. We've seen real estate prices, Ryan, here rise. Our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner now in California. I mean, we're seeing homes here that are track homes, 2,500, 2,800 square feet. They're now going for $1.5 million, and that's San Diego. It gets worse if you go north up the coast in California.
So the horizon is pretty short, meaning that rental inflation, housing, its impact on inflation is coming soon, in the next, you know, few months. There's a big lag between when some of the alternative data on rents or house prices, you know, looking at, you know, Zillow, for example, and when it shows up in the consumer price index, it's roughly a 12-month lag. So we're going to start seeing rental inflation over the next several months, probably peaking this summer. And based on the CPI, it's going to be 6-7% year over year. If we don't get goods disinflation, so, you know, our narrative is supply chain issues, they ease, that takes a lot of pressure off. Goods inflation, you know, used car prices, you know, if you squint, you start to see that they've come down a little bit. They should continue to fall. But if that doesn't come to fruition and we get this rental inflation, then we have a more serious problem when it comes to inflation. And I think that's what's concerning the Fed. We've seen inflation expectations. They've creeped higher recently. Some of that is, market-based measures. Some of that's attributed to energy prices. They closely track oil prices. Consumers, their inflation expectations have also moved higher. That's most likely attributed to gasoline, food prices, because consumers, they base their expectations on future inflation on things that they see on a regular basis. So, gas prices and food prices. The Fed doesn't want inflation expectations getting dislodged. So far, they're not dislodged, but if they continue to creep higher, I think that's embedded in market expectations for why the Fed may have to raise rates seven times this year. If they do raise rates seven times this year, it's going to be very difficult on the economy, not this year, because there's a long lag between changes in monetary policy and when it affects broader economic activity and inflation. So no matter the number of rate hikes the Fed does this year, it's not going to have an appreciable impact on realized inflation until sometime next year. But with the Fed raising rates, financial market conditions are going to tighten. A lot of the growth that we're going to get this year, GDP growth, is going to be in inventories. And what they add to growth this year, they'll likely subtract from growth next year. So I think we're setting up for, I'm really concerned about the economy in 2023 and in 2024. This is really turning out to be more of a boom bust type cycle.
How would you contrast this? Typically, Ryan, in the past, we've seen the Fed tightening when the economy was booming and then inflation was rising along with that. One of the precursors to recession, which we're seeing now, has been a spike in energy prices. How do you think this makes it different or maybe more difficult for the Fed? Because if the economy was booming, kind of like what we saw last year when we were coming out of the pandemic, this time they're sort of tightening into a slowing cycle. Doesn't that make it a little tougher on the Fed?
It makes it really difficult on the Fed. I'm not concerned about oil prices causing a recession now. You're correct. You're absolutely 100% correct that in the past, oil prices have caused or contributed to economic downturns. But the U.S. economy has changed since then. We're less dependent on energy. If you look at consumer spending that goes towards gasoline as a share of total consumption, it's a lot lower today than it was just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So we're a little bit less sensitive. Also, higher oil prices, higher energy prices lead to a supply response in the U.S. You get more fracking, you get more active rotary rig counts in the Gulf of Mexico. And that causes a lot of business investment in energy-related equipment, in mining. And that helps offset some of the hit to consumer spending. So on net, it's still higher oil prices are a negative for the U.S. economy. It's just less of a drag than it was, if you go back 10, 15, 20 years. But from the Fed's perspective, energy is going to cause their inflation problems to get worse over the next few months. And this is uncharted territory with regards to the last 20, 30 years where the Fed's tightening and trying to bring inflation down. Whereas before, we had very low and stable inflation, and the Fed's problem is really getting inflation up. It took a pandemic to bring inflation back to the U.S. And, this time the Fed's going to be in a much more difficult situation when it comes to tightening.
So in your opinion, what could go wrong here? In other words, the Fed in the past, they keep raising rates and they end up overdoing it, and we don't get a soft landing. What are the risks here? What can go wrong in your opinion?
There's a lot of things that can go wrong, unfortunately. The Fed's starting tightening, to your earlier point, when the economy is losing some momentum. We're still going to have very strong GDP growth this year, probably close to 3-4%, which is above the economy's potential of 2%. We're past peak growth. So the economy is moderating, and the Fed's going to be just beginning to embark on their tightening cycle. And when we talk about monetary policy, it's not just them raising interest rates. In a few months, they're going to start reducing the size of their balance sheet. And it's very unclear how those two tools will interact with one another. They could cause, a lot more stress in financial markets than, the Fed's anticipating. So, there's a lot of monetary policy tightening that's coming down the road, not just from rate hikes, but also a smaller balance sheet. And that creates some uncertainty. Getting back to inventories, that could cause inventories have, just like oil prices, have caused recessions in the past. And again, the idea that, you know, we have long economic expansions may not hold this time around because of the nature of this recession and subsequent recovery. It's looking and feeling a lot more like a boom bust type cycle. And that's very difficult for the Fed to engineer a soft landing. So things that could go wrong, I think, you know, high on the list is a Fed policy error. They either raise rates too aggressively. Inflation could be persistently higher than what we're anticipating, which would then lead the Fed to really slam their foot on the brake. And that, you know, sets us up for a recipe for a recession. And the other thing is the Fed's starting to raise interest rates when the yield curve is flattening. And they're not going to want to invert the yield curve because, you know, that there's a psychological impact to that. You know, when that occurs, you know, markets start to really discount the probability of a recession in the near-term horizon.
So those are the things that could possibly go wrong. In your opinion, what could possibly go right?
There's a few things. You know, in aggregate, consumers are sitting on a boatload of cash. We have $2.6 trillion in excess savings. And excess savings is the additional amount of money that's, you know, sitting in consumers' checking accounts or under their mattress, you know, today versus maintained savings patterns pre-pandemic. A lot of that excess savings is because of, you know, fiscal stimulus and the pandemic, where, you know, people weren't able to go out to restaurants, and if they didn't spend on goods, they kind of pocket it and put it in their checking account. If consumers treat that as cash, you know, that's going to be, you know, that's a lot of firepower for consumer spending. So that could be a positive for the economy, but also a negative for inflation. You know, there's going to be more money chasing fewer goods, so that's a recipe for higher inflation. But from a GDP growth perspective, you know, if consumers treat this as cash, you know, and spend it, that could really boost GDP. Our assumption is that they treat it as wealth. Most of the excess savings is in higher income cohorts, and it's more likely that, you know, they're going to treat it as wealth rather than cash. But that is something that could go right. Something else that could be a positive is that supply chains, abstaining from the temporary effect of China shutting down two of their provinces, but if supply chains improve much more quickly than we're anticipating, that would be that's a lot of disinflation that would come, that would bring inflation down, maybe, you know, help the Fed, you know, ease off the brake and tighten less aggressively. But so there's a few things that can go right. Unfortunately, the number of things that can go right it's a lot fewer than the number of things that could go wrong.
So no recession in 2022, in your opinion, but 2023 is open. Things could, maybe that's where we feel the impact of all this.
Yeah, there's no recession this year, you know, barring any unforeseen, by definition, a recession is usually caused by some sort of shock in financial systems and imbalance somewhere in the economy. So I don't think there's a recession this year, but, you know, I'm concerned about 2023 just because we're going to have a Fed that is tightening aggressively, both raising interest rates and reducing the size of their balance sheet at a time when financial market conditions are less supportive and the economy is moderating. I wouldn't, you know, ignore inventories. I think that's something to pay very close attention to because, again, getting back to supply chains, you know, business inventories for retailers, wholesalers, manufacturers are very, very lean. And businesses, you know, they can adapt and they recognize that there's supply chain issues. So they're double ordering, triple ordering, and that's going to boost GDP this year. But there's a potential that businesses wake up in 2023 and realize that they have too much inventory and they start cutting inventories. And that would be a drag on economic activity. And, you know, we're not going to be getting the 4% GDP growth this year, next year, and inventories can, as we learned in the fourth quarter of last year, make the difference between positive GDP growth and a decline.
So I guess as we conclude here, Ryan, expect a bumpy ride this year and possibly even next year.
I think, you know, the Fed has a very, very difficult task ahead of them. It's possible that they engineer a soft landing, but, you know, they're trying to land this plane, you know, in the midst of a fog of, you know, uncertainty around where inflation's headed, uncertainty around supply chains, uncertainty around how tight the U.S. labor market is. And then we also have geopolitical tensions, and that's just adding another layer of uncertainty. So, you know, the Fed's going to land the plane, but whether or not it's a soft landing or a hard landing is still up for debate. You know, our forecast assumes that the Fed pulls it off and we get a relatively soft landing, maybe a few bumps here and there, But the Fed is able to engineer a soft landing where we get inflation back down closer to their target without really disrupting the economy or pushing us into a recession.
Well, super. Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, if people like to follow the work that you guys do at Moody's, I mean, you guys cover quite a comprehensive list of indicators, not just here in the U.S., but around the globe with a lot of commentary. How could they do so?
You can go to our the Moody's Analytics Economic View platform. It's our real-time economic analysis platform. So we cover the global economy around the clock, 24 hours a day, seemingly 7 days a week now. But we cover more than 300 key economic indicators, and we provide a daily commentary on what's going on with global fiscal policy, monetary policy, and we cover the economy around the clock.
Thanks so much for joining us on the program. You have a great weekend, and I hope you come back and talk to us again.
America is the largest producer of nuclear power in the world, with 56 nuclear plants in nearly 30 different states. Altogether, they provide about 20% of America's electricity needs, with some states getting over half or more of their electricity from nuclear power alone. Question is, where does the U.S. get the fuel it needs to run these large and powerful reactors? Well, almost all of it comes from imports in the form of enriched uranium, and the most commentators have focused on Russia's abundant oil, gas, and wheat exports. America is actually much, much more dependent on Russia for uranium. On today's FS Insider, we discuss the economic and geopolitical implications of this dependency, as well as Russia's strategic importance to the global nuclear industry as a whole.
As for Russia, they are undoubtedly one of the biggest players in the nuclear power sector in the world. They are Rosatom, the state-owned entity, is the market leader in various parts of the nuclear industry, with, for example, 76% of global nuclear technology exports coming from them in the form of 35 different nuclear power plants in 12 countries around the world. And the number is only poised to grow as more and more countries in the world realize that nuclear power is the way forward, both in terms of energy security, as well as reliable, green, baseload power.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. Chris Poplav is our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, last time we spoke with you 2 weeks ago, you had discussed how there were some signs of a potential bottom in the market. We had reached deeply oversold levels. And with that, we had taken advantage of the dip in the markets to nibble back in slightly with some convertible bonds where you saw very attractive valuations at the time. However, you did say, didn't quite think that this was the bottom. It may have just been a temporary bottom because, as we've been discussing with you for many months now, going back to late last year, the credit markets are continuing to deteriorate and flashing a warning signal for the broader equity markets. So with that said, where do things stand today?
Well, Chris, I don't think we're done quite yet. But as you and I have discussed, you have to use times of volatility to your advantage. And that's what we started to do. Essentially, when you own a bond, the coupon that you're going to get is more or less going to be the rate of return if you're buying something near par value. And so when you look at the fixed income spectrum, it's still not attractive, even with the recent rise in rates. For example, a 30-year treasury is only at 2.4%. 30 years at 2.4. That's a lousy return. You look at a 10-year, lower duration, that's only at 2.14. You look at a 5-year, also 2.14. You look at a 3-month T-bill, maybe you're getting 40 basis points. So the fixed income market, even with a backup in interest rates, is still very unattractive at this time. And so for us, what we're trying to do is when we see markets dislocate, and we are in touch with many bond dealers, you know, there are times where people need liquidity. Customers need to raise some cash, you know, whether you're an ETF, mutual fund, or family wealth office, and a client needs to raise cash, you go to the, you know, your market dealers and you offload some debt. Well, you know, that's where we can come in to take advantage of that with our high cash position, where we get approached by dealers and they'll say, look, I've got, several million of this bond. Here's what it is. Here's what the yield is. And we can take advantage of that. And so that's what we've been doing the last 2 weeks or so is we're starting to buy some convertible debt where it's not mandatory conversion, it's an optional. So essentially what that means is that we don't have to convert to the equity when it matures. We could just let the bond mature and get paid back. And I like that because I know exactly what the return is going to be absent a default. And on some of these convertibles, you know, we're looking at yields of 4 to 5% yield to maturity. And this week we had an attractive opportunity when the market was declining. We picked up a bond that matures next July, so literally just over a one-year bond. And at the time, we got almost 5% yield to maturity. So it has over a 2% coupon. It's selling at a discount. And so that's, you know, a little over a year and we're going to get almost 5%. But that's what I mean when you got to take advantage when, you know, there's panic and people are selling in mass. That's the time to buy. And it's easier to do on the fixed income side, Chris, because again, you know, if you buy a bond, you know when it's going to mature and you know what your coupon's going to be. You buy a stock, you don't know what's going to happen, you know, 3 months from now, 6 months from now. So that's why we're being a little bit cautious in terms of what we're doing on the equity front. We are looking at some attractive areas, slowly putting some money to work when the market's lower. But, you know, from a big picture perspective, Chris, you know, kind of my gut tells me is that we're in a trading range. You know, typically over the last several years, when we have a double digit decline and the market starts to rally, that's typically the bottom. And then we rally, we hit the former highs, and then we exceed those and we continue on. I don't think that's what's in store for us. When you look at the economy, you can have accelerating growth where you're going from 0 to 1 to +2, +3, +4, +5% growth. And then you can have growth slowdowns where you're still positive, but you're decelerating. You're going on the other side where you're going from +5, +4, +3, +2. Typically, during those periods where growth slows down, earnings growth slows down, consumer spending tends to slow down, the growth in jobs tends to slow down, and the economy decelerates. And typically, risk assets tend to do still positive, but not as strongly, perform as strongly as when the economy is accelerating. Now, the question always is when you have a growth slowdown, every growth slowdown is a prelude to a recession, but not every growth slowdown leads to a recession. So we've had many growth slowdowns without a recession, and that period of 2015 into 2016 was an example of that. We did have a growth slowdown, but did not lead to a recession. But that's always the risk when you have a slowdown, is that you don't touch and go. You don't, you know, reaccelerate and start to go higher in economic growth. So that's kind of what I see as a somewhat similar roadmap. Typically, the Fed raises rates into an accelerating economy, not a decelerating one. And that's what we have in store for us. We have a slowing economy both abroad and here in the U.S., still growth, but slowing. And we have a central bank that is now tightening. And so I think the Fed will be surprised at how much slowing we have ahead of us, particularly as inflation eats into consumer pocketbooks. So my guess is that until we get a lot of these headwinds behind us, geopolitical uncertainty, the high inflation rates, the hit to consumers' pocketbooks, that I don't think it's going to be similar to prior declines where we declined double digits, rallied, and then ultimately hit new highs in short order. I think we've got some digestion ahead of us. And, you know, again, if you think back to the 14 to 16 trading range, from the peak to trough, we were looking around a 15% decline. And from the trough to the peak, we're looking around 17.5% rally. So, you know, when you're in a trading range, you don't put money to work near the highs. You wait for the opportunity when you trade near the lower end of the range. And so given that we are making some of the progress back, you know, my gut tells me, Chris, I think maybe on the high end, our trading range is probably going to be 4,600, basically the February highs. I really don't see us exceeding those levels for a while. And possibly on the low end, you know, maybe 4,000 or 3,800. So basically, you know, I think we've got a 600 to 800 point trading range in the S&P, and we're at least, you know, in terms of my view, approaching the upper end of that. I really don't see us kind of breaching 4,600 because I still think we're going to have high commodity prices, high inflation, and a hawkish central banks to deal with. So as we approach that upper end of the range, you know, Chris, I think we're looking more at maybe de-risking some equities. And on the fixed income front, if I can lock in 4, 5, 6% yields, I'm going to do that all day long because I do think interest rates will stay constrained, you know, and low for the foreseeable future. I think they're going to rise, but I just don't see interest rates moving up to 4 or 5%. So if I can lock in on a short-term corporate bond, a rate like that, I'd take that over a 10 to 30-year treasury any day.
Well, it's interesting, Chris, because we're recording this interview right after we just spoke with Tom McClellan on our show. That aired in the first segment of today's show. And I know you haven't yet heard what Tom McClellan did have to say, but his outlook is for a highly volatile sideways trading action in the market for this year. And as you know, he did call the top in the market in November. We spoke with him last November, and he was very definitive in his call that this is the peak. So we got an update from him today. And he's also looking at, a volatile sideways trading range in the market. So in that case, you know, as you said, we're looking at coordinated global slowing, a deceleration in economic growth across the globe. At the same time, we're also seeing coordinated tightening by central banks. The Fed has now finally moved to a 25 basis point hike off of the zero bound. They're likely to continue with more hikes. Ryan Sweet from Moody's in our last segment said that they don't think that the Fed is going to be able to get in 7 hikes. They're thinking it's probably going to be more like 4 this year and 4 next year, given the deceleration that we're seeing as well. So I guess the big picture here, the main message is, with this landscape that we're facing, this investment landscape, the message to our clients, other portfolio managers that listen to the show, as well as, you know, global investors, is you need to be tactical. You need to be using these moves both up and down as opportunities to make changes to your portfolio, but don't expect, you know, runaway bull market or runaway bear market. It's probably going to be more of a trading range, at least for the remainder of this year.
That would be my guess. And, you know, my view really does dovetail, I think, Chris, in alignment with that recent interview you did with David Wu, the former B of A strategist. You know, we've got a lot of headwinds. You know, he cited a lot of them, and I agree they're going to be there. You know, for example, you've got oil that went as high as $130 a barrel. Right now, West Texas is at 105. But let's just say oil goes down to, you know, let's say $85 a barrel by this summer. Well, you know, back in July of 2021, you know, oil was around 70. So even if oil dips down to, let's say, 85 and drops, you know, another $20 a barrel, I mean, that's still a 20% plus inflation rate year over year in energy. And that's going to spill over into the overall CPI index. And owner's equivalent rent, I believe, will still remain sticky for quite some time. So I think we're going to have elevated inflation levels for a while here that we're going to have to grapple with, as well as continue decelerating economy, both here and abroad. And who knows what ends up happening with Russia and Ukraine. You know, even let's say if Russia decides and Ukraine come to agreement, how long before the U.S. and its allies remove the restrictions and sanctions that are placed on Russia? That may not occur right away. And then you also have the, you know, sourcing of Russian oil. I mean, the UK talked about exiting their imports of Russia by the end of this year. Where is that oil going to get redistributed? So, you know, there's a lot of disruptions that will be with us for months on end, even if we have a peaceful resolution in Russia and Ukraine.
Chris, you mentioned the interview we did with David Wu on FS Insider this week. One of the reasons we wanted to bring him on was to get his view on a so-called VAR shock that he's warning about, which I assumed was in reference to another Russian debt default. And I know you listened to that interview, but for those of our listeners that didn't hear what he had to say, he's actually looking at something much bigger than a Russian debt default when it comes to a wide-scale portfolio adjustment heading into a stagflationary environment. Here's what he had to say on that point.
I think in general, we're moving towards stagflation. And in a stagflation environment, bond's not going to do that much for you. You know, in a stagflation environment, everybody will have to basically, because if bonds don't have this negative correlation with stocks, that means people will have to basically cut back their holding of stocks. That means the world owns too much stocks. That will have big impact on stock market valuation. From the point of view that most investors these days, they basically target their risk exposure by using some kind of VAR system. And if you don't have this negative correlation in your portfolio, you're taking a lot more risk than you would like to that you can stomach. Therefore, you have to basically reduce your stock holdings.
And Chris, the interesting thing he had to say on that was, like you had said, how it fit within the context of growing geopolitical tensions, inflation, and us being in the beginning stages of what he believes to be a second Cold War. If any of you haven't listened to that full interview yet, it ran about 45 minutes. And we covered quite a bit of interesting ground. Since it was part of our weekday series of interviews, that we conduct on FS Insider. Just click subscribe on our website, Financial Sense, and you can sign up. So Chris, in summary of what we discussed today, we're likely to be looking at a volatile trading range in the market here. Investors need to be taking advantage of these tactical opportunities, both on the upside and on the downside, to make changes to their portfolios. As you mentioned 2 weeks ago, we did take advantage of the last pretty steep decline that we saw for some areas in the convertible bond market, but we still have a fairly decent cash position and are overweight materials and energy.
That is correct. We have put some money to work, mostly in the commodity space. In terms of equities, we are taking advantage in terms of the fixed income market, particularly in convertibles. But in terms of cash, we still have a lot of cash. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I think we're getting to the upper end of what I feel is going to be a trading range for the foreseeable future. And this isn't the time to put money to work. This is time to maybe lighten up on things that you wished you could have sold earlier, but didn't have the opportunity to.
Chris, it was a pleasure getting an update from you again. And as always, if any of you would like to get in touch with us about our financial planning or asset management services, feel free to give us a call at 858-487-3939. Or you can also go to our website, financialsense.com, and click where it says Contact Us. On behalf of the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.